You're listening to part 2 of Unwelcome Guests number 585. We continue with the soundtrack of a video called Freetopia by Mike Adams, whose focus is health matters. It's slightly inside the box in some ways, but I think it gives a good overview of dependency culture and the powerlessness which accompanies the institution of wage slavery.
Not long ago, there was once a land of freedom and abundance called Freetopia. There, the people worked the land. They grew and harvested and sometimes even smoked plants provided by Mother Nature. Most families farmed at least part-time, and while they weren't materially wealthy, they were largely happy. Parents spent quality time with their children. The family had time outdoors working the farms. Rates of disease were very low, and crime was extremely rare too. As a result, there were hardly any prisons in Freetopia. And due to the outstanding health of the citizens, there were hardly any hospitals either. There were no cancer centers, no diabetes clinics, and no Alzheimer's nonprofits, because those diseases hardly existed. Doctors made house calls and charged reasonable rates that nearly everyone could afford. There was no insurance paperwork to fill out, and for those who truly couldn't afford to see the doctor, local churches and civic groups donated the money out of compassion. One day, something called television was introduced to Freetopia. Television brought the citizens commercial images of all the worldly things they didn't have. Teeth whiteners, riding lawnmowers, hair dyes, fashion shoes, cosmetic surgery, and, of course, bling. Upon seeing all this, the people of Freetopia unanimously screamed, "We are inadequate!" They formed a committee to find out how they could solve the problem of being inadequate. It was quickly decided they all needed more money to purchase the goods they saw on television. Then they would all feel more adequate. So they voted into existence a government and gave it the power to run their lives, with the instructions that the government should focus on finding ways for everyone to have more money so they could all buy more stuff and thereby feel more adequate. The government sprang into action, announcing, "We shall create jobs!" The people of Freetopia cheered. Within just a few months, the government had created tens of thousands of prison guard jobs and government law enforcement jobs by criminalizing hemp, thereby turning hemp growers into criminals. Soon, millions of people across Freetopia were arrested, and prisons became a booming industry, hiring hundreds of thousands of government workers to serve prison food, guard the prisoners, and write colorful reports touting how much they were all helping society. Cheap prison labor also helped manufacturing companies make money, and the government said that was good for the economy too. Despite all this success creating jobs, the people of Freetopia didn't feel more adequate. They actually felt less free. So they demanded their government take action to create yet more jobs to compensate. The government replied, "We shall unleash economic stimulus programs." It then hired 500,000 people to walk around the country and count all the other people who were told to stand really still, so that a report could be written which announced the total number of all the people in Freetopia. This report was called the census, but it only created jobs for a short while. So some demanded a recount for continued job security. One government authority suggested they could create even more jobs by hiring people to run around the cities, smashing in all the windows of all the buildings, thereby creating thousands of new jobs for window replacers. Expanding on that idea, a senior military official suggested that since war always resulted in an economic boom, the military could just bomb all the major cities of Freetopia and the nation would experience a golden age of abundance as a result. But the government ultimately decided to pursue a less ambitious plan. It would stimulate the healthcare economy by outlawing vitamins, herbs, and nutritional supplements, thereby encouraging people to become more sick and diseased. Shortly after this law went into effect, hospital business boomed. Jobs were created in the cancer industry. Salaries for nurses skyrocketed. And the pharmaceutical industry, which was suddenly allowed to advertise its chemical products on television, began hiring sales reps in droves. As diabetes, cancer, and heart disease swept through the population, the healthcare industry saw record profits and was widely commended for saving the economy and contributing to the nation's GDP. But with all the drug advertising appearing on television, the people began to demand even more economic stimulus so that they could afford to buy erection pills and antidepressants to help give them a mental lift while their bodies eroded into painful degenerative disease. But even as they took more medications, the people of Freetopia still didn't feel more adequate. In fact, they felt more disconnected and depressed. So they demanded their government do something else to create even more jobs, hoping they would find new solutions that worked better. The government replied, "We shall protect you from terrorism." It hired demolitions experts to stage the collapse of a skyscraper and blame it on foreign terrorists. With terrorism as the justification, the government created a Department of Motherland Security and hired hundreds of thousands of agents to walk around airports, public stadiums, and city streets, carrying government-issued firearms and searching people by reaching down their pants and feeling their genitals. This was called security. The government then proceeded to outlaw the private ownership of firearms, causing local crime to skyrocket, which of course resulted in even more economic stimulus in the prison industry, which was growing almost as fast as the hospitals and the pharmaceutical giants. The people of Freetopia cheered the action, screaming, "Protect us from terrorism!" even though none of them had ever been threatened by an actual terrorist or even seen one. But the government proceeded to stage elaborate news propaganda campaigns in order to make the public believe it was finding and killing terrorists overseas. Government policy quickly became government theater. Despite the government's self-congratulatory success on the terrorism front, the economic stimulus programs still weren't working for most citizens, and the people of Freetopia found themselves poorer, sicker, and less free. They turned to television for entertainment, filling the emptiness of their lives by watching a show called Cops that featured people being arrested, beaten, and tasered for the crime of smoking certain plants. Meanwhile, prices were rising all around them: food, fuel, clothing, and even housing. One man ran for office by creating the "Rent is Too Damn High" party. As inflation eroded the value of their dollars and made their savings less valuable by the day, the citizens became desperate to be rescued by government, which they now worship as their provider of all things, forgetting that their ancestors had once provided for themselves and actually created the government. From such ignorance, they demanded one last time, "Give us more government money!" The government responded rapidly, enacting a program that allowed the government to take money out of every paycheck of every worker in the nation and then give that money back to them a few decades later when that worker retired. This was called Social Security. But when that still didn't do the trick, the government decided to give away $16 trillion in economic stimulus money. Instead of giving the money away to the people, though, it gave the money to the nation's wealthiest bankers, hoping that perhaps the bankers would distribute some of those trillions of dollars by dropping suitcases full of cash from open helicopters. But they didn't. They just kept the money, paid themselves bigger bonuses, and bought more erection pills. The people of Freetopia, who were now disarmed, diseased, and indebted, realized they were in a bind. But now, having grown up on the idea that the state was their savior, they could only turn to government yet again, screaming, "We need bigger government to solve all of these big problems!" And so they cheered as the government launched into existence new regulators called FDA, USDA, DEA, EPA, ATF, FTC, and many other letters of the alphabet. Each department then launched its own private army of enforcers to maximize its power over the nation. Soon, government agents began policing home gardens, sports stadiums, high school dances, and random road checkpoints. People were arrested for growing tomatoes in their own front yards or rescuing baby woodpeckers because they are a protected species. Farmers' markets were outlawed, holistic cancer clinics were raided and shut down, and pioneering cancer researchers were arrested by the government and thrown in prison. Jobs disappeared by the day as Freetopia's employers fled the country, which had devolved into an impossible place to conduct business. Jobless claims skyrocketed, so the government passed new laws allowing the jobless to collect paychecks from the government itself, even when they weren't working. Before long, 4 out of every 5 people in Freetopia were dependent on the government for their incomes, and the once prominent ideas of entrepreneurship, self-worth, and dignity quickly faded. Increasingly, Freetopians saw themselves as helpless dependents who had no control over their own lives. One day, a little boy who was studying history for a school paper read a chapter describing the history of Freetopia. Puzzled by the differences between past Freetopia and present Freetopia, he asked his mother, "Mom, how come Freetopia used to have people who were healthy and happy, but today everybody is sick, unhappy, and broke?" His mother, a loyal supporter of the Freetopia government, replied, "But son, today we are safe from terrorism. Our food supply is sterilized and no longer dangerous. The government saves our money for retirement for us. The prisons keep dangerous criminals away from society. The pharmaceutical industry is finding cures for all the diseases we have. And we are on the verge of an economic recovery. All we need is more government, and we will be living in a utopia." And so, because most people agreed with his mother, Freetopia devolved into a police state government. Private sector jobs all but disappeared, as most jobs shifted to the government itself, which ran a centralized command economy that specialized in spying on its own citizens and imprisoning those who questioned the need for such things as a balanced budget or citizens' rights. Once created by the people to serve the people, the government of Freetopia had now become a ruler over the people, and it demanded their obedience. Any who questioned the wisdom of government rule or who claimed they had rights were labeled terrorists and thrown into secret prisons where they were kept indefinitely without even being charged with crimes, as any such rights had long ago been stripped away by the government itself. All this government activity cost a lot of money, of course, because the government could not pay for all its expenses merely by taxing the people. It borrowed money from other nations and dug itself deep into debt. When other nations realized how much debt had been accrued and stopped lending money, the government simply printed its own currency and used it to keep spending on government salaries, entitlements, imperialist wars, and other programs that it insisted were all good for the people of Freetopia. But talk about the failure of big government began to grow. So in order to prevent the people from questioning its authority, the government staged repeated terrorist attacks on its own cities, using biological and radiological weapons. In the virulent fear that ensued, the government demanded complete obedience and loyalty from the citizens of Freetopia, over which it now ruled by force. All forms of communication were now monitored by the government, and the citizens were microchipped so that their physical movements could be tracked in a secret government database. One day, just as things seemed to be beyond hope, the government monstrosity of Freetopia breathed its last fiscal breath and collapsed into insolvency. The government paychecks stopped. The government jobs vanished. The currency became worthless overnight, and the capital city imploded into chaos and rioting. As the government collapsed, so did government restrictions on herbal medicines, hemp farming, and private firearms ownership. So the people began growing their own medicines, farming industrial hemp for clothing and textile production, and openly carrying firearms on their hips to protect themselves from the outbreaks of violence and looting. Armed vigilante groups sprang up to protect neighborhoods and small towns, and violent crime soon vanished everywhere except in the largest cities, where only the criminals had been stockpiling guns and thus had a tactical advantage over the disarmed population. As agriculture was now set free, farmers reaped huge rewards from the growing of hemp seeds, hemp fibers, and hemp oils. Some of them smoked a little hemp and felt hungry, so they began to plant their own gardens and grow tomatoes, corn, cucumbers, and potatoes. Dairy farmers freely produced raw milk and cheese, fresh eggs, and non-hormone injected meat. Crop producers saved their own seeds and planted non-GMO crops generation after generation with steady abundance. The people of Freetopia now kept their own paychecks and weren't taxed by a government that promised to save their money for them. Production skyrocketed, business flourished, employers returned to Freetopia and began hiring workers in droves. With the government gone, taxes were no longer confiscated out of their paychecks, so workers had more money to spend, which stimulated the economy and put the nation back on track to economic recovery. Absent the intimidation of the FDA and USDA, local food and medicine production quickly multiplied. The people became healthier, and soon that led to them becoming happier too. Disease rates plummeted as people got more sunshine, fresh foods, and natural medicine. Hospitals shuttered their doors, cancer clinics filed for bankruptcy, and the pharmaceutical industry, which had been propped up by an FDA-enforced monopoly, collapsed into ruin. The people of Freetopia now had farms and freedoms and family. They kept what they earned and lived peacefully in a society that they now realized was more just, more free, and more abundant than the government-run society which had enslaved and nearly destroyed them. They vowed to protect their freedoms at any cost and to prevent the rise of dangerous government from ever happening again. One day, a slick young man with finely shaped hair and a sharp business suit spoke to the nation and insisted everyone would be better off if they all pitched in and created a new government to stimulate the economy. The people of Freetopia promptly hanged the man from a tree and returned to their farms to continue living as free people, without the curse of big government burdening their lives. The man's body swayed silently in the breeze, along with a sign the citizens had created and strapped to his chest. It read, "We predict future happiness for Freetopians if they can prevent the government from wasting the labors of the people under the pretense of taking care of them." And that's the story of what happened in Freetopia.
Now, we conclude the show this week by returning to our reading of David Graeber's Debt, the First 5,000 Years. This is in the middle of Chapter 7, Honor and Degradation, or On the Foundation of Contemporary Civilization. Last week, we concluded with David Graeber's asking why Equiano, the slave, was so reluctant to challenge the institution of slavery, and my echoing that, wondering what this told us about 21st century people's slowness to recognize and object to the institution of wage slavery.
For most of his early life, Equiano was not opposed to the institution of slavery. At one point, while saving money to buy his freedom, he even briefly took a job that involved purchasing slaves in Africa. Equiano only came round to the abolitionist position after converting to Methodism and falling in with religious activists against the trade. Many have asked, why did it take him so long? Surely, if anyone had reason to understand the evils of slavery, he did. The answer seems, oddly, to lie in the man's very integrity. One thing that comes through strikingly in the book is that this was not only a man of endless resourcefulness and determination, but above all, a man of honour. Yet this created a terrible dilemma. To be made a slave is to be stripped of any possible honour. Equiano wished, above all else, to regain what had been taken from him. The problem is that honour is, by definition, something that exists in the eyes of others. To be able to recover it, then, the slave must necessarily adopt the rules and standards of the society that surrounds him. And this means that, in practice at least, he can't absolutely reject the institutions that deprived him of his honour in the first place. It strikes me that this experience of only being able to restore one's lost honour, to regain the ability to act with integrity by acting in accord with the terms of a system that one knows, through deeply traumatic personal experience, to be utterly unjust, is itself one of the most profoundly violent aspects of slavery. It is another example, perhaps, of the need to argue in the master's language, but here taken to insidious extremes. All societies based on slavery tend to be marked by this agonizing double consciousness, the awareness that the highest things one has to strive for are also ultimately wrong, but at the same time the feeling that this is simply the nature of reality. This might help explain why throughout history, when slaves did rebel against their masters, they rarely rebelled against slavery itself. But the flip side of this is that even slave owners seem to feel that the whole arrangement was somehow fundamentally perverse or unnatural. First-year Roman law students, for instance, were made to memorize the following definition. Slavery is an institution according to the law of nations whereby one person falls under the property rights of another, contrary to nature. At the very least, there was always seemed to be something disreputable and ugly about slavery. Anyone too close to it was tainted. Slave traders particularly were scorned as inhuman brutes. Throughout history, moral justifications for slavery are rarely taken seriously, even by those who espouse them. For most of human history, most people saw slavery much as we see war. A tawdry business, to be sure, but one would have to be naive indeed to imagine it could simply be eliminated. Honour is surplus dignity. So, what is slavery? I have already begun to suggest an answer in that last chapter. Slavery is the ultimate form of being ripped from one's context, and thus from all social relationships that make one a human being. Another way to put this is that the slave is, in a very real sense, dead. This was the conclusion of the first scholar to carry out a broad historical survey of the institution, an Egyptian sociologist named Ali Abd al-Wahid Wafi, in Paris in 1931. Everywhere, he observes, from the ancient world to the then-present-day South America, one finds the same list of possible ways whereby a free person might be reduced to slavery. 1. By the law of force. A. By surrender or capture in war. Or B. By being the victim of raiding or kidnapping. 2. As a legal punishment for crimes, including debt. 3. Through paternal authority, a father's sale of his children. Or 4. through the voluntary sale of oneself. Everywhere, too, capture in war is considered the only way that is considered absolutely legitimate. All the others were surrounded by moral problems. Kidnapping was obviously criminal, and parents would not sell children except under desperate circumstances. We read of famines in China so severe that thousands of poor men would castrate themselves in the hope that they might sell themselves as eunuchs at court. But this was also seen as a sign of total social breakdown. Even the judicial process could easily be corrupted, as the ancients were well aware, especially when it came to enslavement for debt. On one level, Al-Wahid's argument is just an extended apologia for the role of slavery in Islam. Widely criticized, since Islamic law never eliminated slavery, even when the institution largely vanished in the rest of the medieval world. True, he argues, Muhammad did not forbid the practice, but still, the early caliphate was the first government we know of that actually succeeded in eliminating all these practices, judicial abuse, kidnappings, and the sale of offspring, that had been recognized as social problems for thousands of years, and to limit slavery strictly to prisoners of war. The book's most enduring contribution, though, lay simply in asking, what do all these circumstances have in common? Al-Wahid's answer is striking in its simplicity. One becomes a slave in situations where one would otherwise have died. This is obvious in the case of war. In the ancient world, the victor was assumed to have total power over the vanquished, including their women and children, all of whom could simply be massacred. Similarly, he argued, criminals were condemned to slavery only for capital crimes, and those who sold themselves or their children normally faced starvation. And this is not to say, though, that a slave was seen as owing his master his life, since he would otherwise be dead. Perhaps this was true at the moment of his or her enslavement, but after that, a slave could not owe debts, because in almost every important sense, a slave was dead. In Roman law, this was quite explicit. If a Roman soldier was captured and lost his liberty, his family was expected to read his will and dispose of his possessions. Should he later regain his freedom, he would have to start over, even to the point of remarrying the woman who was now considered his widow. In West Africa, according to one French anthropologist, the same principles applied. Quote, once he had been finally removed from his own milieu, through capture, the slave was considered as socially dead, just as if he had been vanquished and killed in combat. Among the Monde, at one time, prisoners of war brought home by conquerors were offered dej, millet and milk porridge, because it was held that a man should not die on an empty stomach, and then presented with their arms so that they could kill themselves. Anyone who refused was slapped on the face by his abductor and kept as a captive. He had accepted the contempt which deprived him of personality. Unquote. Tiv horror stories about men who are dead but don't know it, or who are brought back from the grave to serve their murderers, and Haitian zombie stories all seem to play on this essential horror of slavery, the fact that it's a kind of living death. In a book called Slavery and Social Death, surely the most profound comparative study of the institution yet written, Orlando Patterson works out exactly what it has meant to be so completely and absolutely ripped from one's context. First of all, he emphasizes, slavery is unlike any other form of human relation, because it is not a moral relation. Slave owners might dress it up in all sorts of legalistic or paternalistic language, but really this is just window dressing, and no one really believes it. Really, it's a relation based purely on violence. A slave must obey, because if he doesn't, he can be beaten, tortured, or killed, and everyone is perfectly well aware of this. Second of all, being socially dead means that a slave has no binding moral relations with anyone else. He is alienated from his ancestors, community, family, clan, city. He cannot make contracts or meaningful promises, except at the whim of his master. Even if he acquires a family, it can be broken up at any time. The relation of pure force that attached him to his master was hence the only human relationship that ultimately mattered. As a result, and this is the third essential element, the slave situation was one of utter degradation, hence the mourned warrior's slap. The captive, having refused his one final chance to save his honour by killing himself, must recognise that he will now be considered an entirely contemptible being. Yet, at the same time, this ability to strip others of their dignity becomes, for the master, the foundation of his honour. As Patterson notes, there have been places, the Islamic world affords numerous examples, where slaves are not even put out to work for profit. Instead, rich men make a point of surrounding themselves with battalions of slave retainers simply for reasons of status, as tokens of their magnificence and nothing else. It seems to me that this is precisely what gives honour its notoriously fragile quality. Men of honour tend to combine a sense of total ease and self-assurance, which comes with the habit of command, with a notorious jumpiness, a heightened sensitivity to slights and insults, the feeling that a man, and it is almost always a man, is somehow reduced, humiliated, if any debt of honour is allowed to go unpaid. This is because honour is not the same as dignity. One might even say honour is surplus dignity. It's that heightened consciousness of power and its dangers that comes from having stripped away the power and dignity of others, or at the very least from the knowledge that one is capable of doing so. At its simplest, honour is that excess dignity that must be defended with a knife or sword. Violent men, as we all know, are almost always invariably obsessed with honour. Hence the warrior's ethos, where almost anything that could possibly be seen as a sign of disrespect, an inappropriate word, an inappropriate glance, is considered a challenge, or can be treated as such. Yet, even where overt violence has largely been put out of the picture, wherever honour is at issue, it comes with the sense that dignity can be lost, and therefore must be constantly defended. The result is that to this day, honour has two contradictory meanings. On the one hand, we can speak of honour as simple integrity. Decent people honour their commitments. This is clearly what honour meant for Equiano. To be an honourable man meant to be one who speaks the truth, obeys the law, keeps his promises, is fair and conscientious in his commercial dealings. His problem was that honour simultaneously meant something else, which had everything to do with the kind of violence required to reduce human beings to commodities to begin with. The reader might be asking, but what does all this have to do with the origins of money? The answer is, surprisingly, everything. Some of the most genuinely archaic forms of money we know about appear to have been used precisely as measures of honour and degradation. That is, the value of money was, ultimately, the value of the power to turn others into money. The curious puzzle of the Kumal, the slave girl money of medieval Ireland, would appear to be a dramatic illustration. Honour Price, Early Medieval Ireland. For much of its early history, Ireland's situation was not very different from that of many of the African societies we looked at in the end of the last chapter. It was a human economy, perched uncomfortably on the fringe of an expanding commercial one. What's more, at certain periods there was a very lively slave trade. As one historian put it, Ireland has no mineral wealth, and foreign luxury goods could be brought by Irish kings mainly for two export goods, cattle and people. Hardly surprising, perhaps, that cattle and people were the two major denominations of the currency. Still, by the time our earliest records kick in, about 600 AD, the slave trade appears to have died off, and slavery itself was a waning institution, coming under severe disapproval from the church. Why, then, were Kumal still being used as units of account, to tally up debts that were actually paid out in cows, and in cups and brooches and other objects made of silver, or, in the case of minor transactions, sacks of wheat or oats? And there's an even more obvious question. Why women? There were plenty of male slaves in early Ireland, yet no one ever seems to have used them as money. Most of what we know about the economy of early medieval Ireland comes from legal sources, a series of legal codes drawn up by a powerful class of jurists, dating from the 7th to the 9th centuries AD. These, however, are exceptionally rich. Ireland was, at that time, still very much a human economy. It was also a very rural one. People lived in scattered homesteads, not unlike the Tiv, growing wheat and tending cattle. The closest there were to towns were a few concentrations around monasteries. There appear to have been a near total absence of markets, except for a few on the coast, presumably mainly slave or cattle markets, frequented by foreign ships. As a result, money was employed almost exclusively for social purposes. Gifts, fees to craftsmen, doctors, poets, judges, and entertainers, various feudal payments. Lords gave gifts of cattle to clients who had to regularly supply them with food. The authors of the law codes didn't even know how to put a price on most goods of ordinary use. Pitchers, pillows, chisels, slabs of bacon, and the like, no one seems ever to have paid money for them. Food was shared in families or delivered to feudal superiors, who laid it out in sumptuous feasts for friends, rivals, and retainers. Anyone needing a tool or furniture or clothing either went to a kinsman with irrelevant craft skills and paid someone to make it. The objects themselves were not for sale. Kings, in turn, assigned tasks to different clans. This one was to provide them with leather, this one poets, this one shields, precisely the sort of unwieldy arrangement that markets were later developed to get around. Money could be loaned. There was a highly complex system of pledges and sureties to guarantee that debtors delivered what they owed. Mainly, though, it was used for paying fines. These fines are endlessly and meticulously elaborated in the codes. But what really strikes a contemporary observer is that they were carefully graded by rank. This is true of almost all the barbarian law codes. The size of the penalties usually has at least as much to do with the status of the victim as it does with the nature of the injury. But only in Ireland were things mapped out quite so systematically. The key to the system was a notion of honour, literally, face. One's honour was the esteem one had in the eyes of others, one's honesty, integrity, and character, but also one's power in the sense of the ability to protect oneself and one's family and followers from any sort of degradation or insult. Those who had the highest degree of honour were literally sacred beings. Their persons and possessions were sacrosanct. What was so unusual about Celtic systems, and the Irish one went further with this than any other, was that honour could be precisely quantified. Every free person had his or her honour price, the price that one had to pay for an insult to the person's dignity. These varied. The honour price for a king, for instance, was 7 cumal, 7 slave girls. This was the standard honour price for any sacred being, the same as a bishop or master poet, since, as all sources hasten to point out, slave girls were not normally paid as such. This would mean, in the case of an insult to a person's dignity, one would have to pay 21 milk cows or 21 ounces of silver. The honour price of a wealthy peasant was 2.5 cows, of a minor lord, that plus half a cow additionally for each of his free dependents. And since a lord, to remain a lord, had to have at least 5 of these, that brought him up to at least 5 cows total. Honour price is not to be confused with Wehrgeld, the actual price of a man or woman's life. If one killed a man, one paid goods to the value of 7 kumals in recompense for killing him, to which one then added his honour price for having offended against his dignity by killing him. Interestingly, only in the case of a king are the blood price and his honour price the same. There were also payments for injury. If one wounds a man's cheek, one pays his honour price plus the price of the injury. A blow to the face was, for obvious reasons, particularly egregious. The problem was how to calculate the injury, since this varied according to both the physical damage and the status of the injured party. Here, Irish jurists developed the ingenious expedient of measuring different wounds with different varieties of grain. A cut on the king's cheek was measured in grains of wheat, on that of a substantial farmer in oats, on that of a smallholder merely in peas. One cow was paid for each. Similarly, If one stole, say, a man's brooch or pig, one had to pay back 3 brooches or 3 pigs, plus his honour price, for having violated the sanctity of his homestead. Attacking a peasant under the protection of a lord was the same as raping a man's wife or daughter, a violation of the honour not of the victim, but of the man who should have been able to protect them. Finally, one had to pay the honour price if one simply insulted someone of any importance, say, by turning the person away at a feast, inventing a peculiarly embarrassing nickname, at least if it caught on, or humiliating the person through the use of satire. Mockery was a refined art in medieval Ireland, and poets were considered close to magicians. It was said that a talented satirist could rhyme rats to death, or at the very least raise blisters on the face of victims. Any man publicly mocked would have no choice but to defend his honour, and in medieval Ireland the value of that honour was precisely defined. I should note that while 21 cows might not seem like much when we're dealing with kings, Ireland at that time had about 150 kings. Most had only a couple of thousand subjects, although there were also higher-ranking provincial kings for whom the honour price was double. What's more, since the legal system was completely separate from the political one, jurists, in theory, had the right to demote anyone, including a king, who'd committed a dishonourable act. If a nobleman turned a worthy man away from his door or feast, sheltered a fugitive, or ate steak from an obviously stolen cow, or even if he allowed himself to be satirised and didn't take the offending poet to court, his price could be lowered to that of a commoner. But the same was also true of a king who ran away in battle, or abused his powers, or even was caught working in the fields or otherwise engaging in tasks beneath his dignity. A king who did something utterly outrageous, murdered one of his own relatives, for example, might end up with no honour price at all, which meant not that people could say anything they liked about the king without fear of recompense, but that he couldn't stand as surety or witness in court, as one's oath and standing in law was also determined by one's honour price. This didn't happen often, but it did happen, and legal wisdom made sure to remind people of it. The list, contained in one famous legal text of the 7 kings who lost their honour price, was meant to ensure that everyone remembered that no matter how sacred and powerful, anyone could fall. What's unusual about the Irish material is that it's all spelled out so clearly, and this is partly because Irish law codes were the work of a class of legal specialists who seem to have turned the whole thing almost into a form of entertainment, devoting endless hours to coming up with every possible abstract possibility. Some of the provisos are so whimsical. If stung by another man's bee, one must calculate the extent of the injury, but also, if one swatted it in the process, subtract the replacement value of the bee, though one has to assume that they were simply jokes. Still, as a result, the moral logic that lies behind any elaborate code of honour is laid out here in startling honesty. What about women? A free woman was honoured at precisely 50% of the price of her nearest male relative, her father, if alive, if not, her husband. If she was dishonoured, her price was payable to that relative, unless, that is, she was an independent landholder. In that case, her honour price was the same as that of a man, and unless she was a woman of easy virtue, in which case it was zero, since she had no honour to outrage. What about marriage? The suitor paid the value of the wife's honour to her father and thus became its guardian. What about serfs? The same principle applied. When a landlord acquired a serf, he bought out that man's honour price, presenting him with its equivalent in cows. From that moment on, if anyone insulted or injured the serf, it was seen as an attack on the lord's honour, and it was up to the lord to collect the attendant fees. Meanwhile, the lord's honour price was notched upward as a result of gathering another dependent. In other words, he literally absorbs his new vassal's honour into his own. All this, in turn, makes it possible to understand both something of the nature of honour and why slave girls were kept as units for reckoning debts of honour, even at a time when, owing no doubt to church influence, they no longer actually changed hands. At first sight, it might seem strange that the honour of a nobleman or king might be measured in slaves, since slaves were human beings whose honour was zero. But if one's honour is ultimately founded on one's ability to extract the honour of others, it makes perfect sense. The value of a slave is that of the honour that has been extracted from them. Sometimes one comes upon a single haphazard detail that gives the game away. In this case, it comes not from Ireland, but from the Dymetian Code in Wales, written somewhat later, but operating on much the same principles. At one point, after listing the honours due to the seven holy sees of the kingdom of Diffid, whose bishops and abbots were the most exalted and sacred creatures in the kingdom, the text specifies that, quote, whoever draws blood from an abbot of any of these principal seats before mentioned, let him pay £7, and a female of his kindred to be a washerwoman, as a disgrace to the kindred, and to serve as a memorial to the payment of the honour price. Unquote. A washerwoman was the lowest of servants, and the one turned over in this case was to serve for life. She was, in effect, reduced to slavery. Her permanent disgrace was the restoration of the abbot's honour. While we cannot know if some similar institution once lay behind the habit of reckoning the honour of Irish sacred beings, enslaved women, the principle is clearly the same. Honour is a zero-sum game. A man's ability to protect the women of his family is an essential part of that honour. Therefore, forcing him to surrender a woman of his family to perform menial and degrading chores in another woman's household is the ultimate blow to his honour. This, in turn, makes it the ultimate reaffirmation of the honour of he who takes it away. What makes medieval Irish laws seem so peculiar from our perspective is that their exponents had not the slightest discomfort with putting an exact monetary price on human dignity. For us, the notion that the sanctity of a priest or the majesty of a king could be held equivalent to 1,000,000 fried eggs or 100,000 haircuts is simply bizarre. These are precisely the things that ought to be considered beyond all possibility of quantification. If medieval Irish jurists felt otherwise, it was because people at that time did not use money to buy eggs or haircuts. It was the fact that it was still a human economy, in which money was used for social purposes, that it was quite possible to create such an intricate system whereby it was possible, not just to measure, but to add and subtract specific quantities of human dignity, and in doing so provide us with a unique window into the true nature of honour itself. The obvious question is, what happens to such an economy when people do begin to use the same money used to measure dignity to buy eggs and haircuts? As the history of ancient Mesopotamia and the Mediterranean world reveals, the result was a profound and enduring moral crisis. Mesopotamia, the origins of patriarchy. In ancient Greek, the word for honour was time. In Homer's time, the term appears to have been used, much like the Irish term honour price. It referred both to the glory of the warrior and to the compensation paid as damages in case of injury or insult. Yet, with the rise of markets over the next several centuries, the meaning of the word time began to change. On the one hand, it became the word for price, as in the price of something one buys in the market. On the other, it referred to an attitude of complete contempt for markets. Actually, this is still the case today. In Greece, the word time means honour, which has been typically seen as the most important value in Greek village society. Honour is often characterised in Greece as an open-handed generosity and blatant disregard for monetary costs and counting. And yet, the same word also means price, as in the price for a pound of tomatoes. The word crisis literally refers to a crossroads. It's the point where things could go either of two different ways. The odd thing about the crisis in the concept of honour is that it never seems to have been resolved. Is honour the willingness to pay one's monetary debts? Or is it the fact that one doesn't feel that monetary debts are really that important? It appears to be both at the same time. There's also the question of what men of honour actually do think is important. When most of us think of a Mediterranean village's sense of honour, We don't so much think of a casual attitude toward money as of a veritable obsession with premarital virginity. Masculine honour is caught up not even so much in a man's ability to protect his womenfolk as in his ability to protect their sexual reputations, to respond to any suggestion of impropriety on the part of his mother, wife, sister, or daughter, as if it were a direct physical attack on his own person. Now, this is a stereotype, but it's not entirely unjustified. One historian who went through 50 years of police reports about knife fights in 19th century Ionia discovered that virtually every one of them began when one party publicly suggested that the other's wife or sister was a whore. So, why the sudden obsession with sexual propriety? It doesn't seem to be there in the Welsh or Irish material. There, the greatest humiliation was to see your sister or daughter reduced to scrubbing someone else's laundry. What is it, then, about the rise of money and markets that caused so many men to become so uneasy about sex? Now, this is a difficult question, but, at the very least, one can imagine how a transition from a human economy to a commercial one might cause certain moral dilemmas. What happens, for instance, when the same money once used to arrange marriages and settle affairs of honour can also be used to pay for the services of prostitutes? As we'll see, there is reason to believe that it is in such moral crises that we can find the origin not only of our current conceptions of honour, but of patriarchy itself. This is true, at least, if we define patriarchy in its more specific biblical sense. The role of fathers, with all the familiar images of stern bearded men in robes, keeping a close eye over their sequestered wives and daughters, even as their children kept a close eye over the flocks and herds, familiar from the book of Genesis. Readers of the Bible had always assumed that there was something primordial in all this, that this was simply the way desert people, and thus the earliest inhabitants of the Near East, had always behaved. And this was why the translation of Sumerian in the first half of the 20th century came as something of a shock. In the very earliest Sumerian texts, particularly those from roughly 3000 to 2500 BC, women are everywhere. Early histories not only record the names of numerous female rulers, but make clear that women were well represented amongst the ranks of doctors, merchants, scribes, and public officials, and generally free to take part in all aspects of public life. One cannot speak of full gender equality, men still outnumbered women in all those areas. Still, one gets a sense of society not so different from that which prevails in much of the developed world today. Over the course of the next 1,000 years or so, all this changes. The place of women in civic life erodes. Gradually, the more familiar patriarchal pattern takes shape, with its emphasis on chastity and premarital virginity. A weakening and eventually wholesale disappearance of women's role in government and the liberal professions, and the loss of women's independent legal status, which renders them as wards of their husbands. By the end of the Bronze Age, around 1200 BC, we begin to see large numbers of women sequestered away in harems, and, in some places at least, subjected to obligatory veiling. In fact, this appears to reflect a much broader worldwide pattern. It has always been something of a scandal for those who like to see the advance of science and technology, the accumulation of learning, economic growth, human progress, as we like to call it, as necessarily leading to greater human freedom. That for women, the exact opposite seems to be the case, or at least has been the case until very recent times. A similar gradual restriction on women's freedoms can be observed in India and China. The question is, obviously, why? A standard explanation in the Sumerian case has been the gradual infiltration of pastoralists from the surrounding deserts who, presumably, always had more patriarchal mores. There was, after all, only a narrow strip of land along the Tigris and the Euphrates rivers that could support intensive irrigation works, and hence urban life. Civilization was thus from early times surrounded by a fringe of desert people, who lived much like those described in Genesis, and spoke the same Semitic languages. It is undeniably true that, over the course of time, the Sumerian language was gradually replaced, first by Akkadian, then by Amorite, then by Aramaic languages, and finally, most recently of all, by Arabic, which was also brought to Mesopotamia and the Levant by desert pastoralists. While all this did, clearly, bring with it profound cultural changes as well, it's not a particularly satisfying explanation. Former nomads appear to have been willing to adapt to urban life in any number of other ways. Why not that one? And it's very much a local explanation and does nothing really to explain the broader pattern. Feminist scholarship has instead tended to emphasize the growing scale and social importance of war and the increasing centralization of the state that accompanied it. This is more convincing. Certainly, the more militaristic the state, the harsher its laws tended to be toward women. But I would add another, complementary argument. As I've emphasized, historically, war, states, and markets all tend to feed off one another. Conquest leads to taxes. Taxes tend to be ways to create markets, which are convenient for soldiers and administrators. In the specific case of Mesopotamia, all of this took on a complicated relation to an explosion of debt, which threatened to turn all human relations, and by extension women's bodies, into potential commodities. At the same time, it created a horrified reaction on the part of the winners of the economic game, males, who over time felt forced to go to greater and greater lengths to make clear that their women could in no sense be bought or sold. A glance at the existing material on Mesopotamian marriage gives us a clue as to how this might have happened. It's common anthropological wisdom that bride wealth tends to be typical of situations where population is relatively thin, land not a particularly scarce resource, and therefore politics are all about controlling labour. Where population is dense and land at a premium, one tends to instead find dowry. Adding a woman to the household is adding another mouth to feed, and rather than being paid off, a bride's father is expected to contribute something, land, wealth, or money, to help support his daughter in her new home. In Sumerian times, for instance, the main payment at marriage was a huge gift of food, paid by the groom's father to the brides, destined to provide a sumptuous feast for the wedding. Before long, however, this seems to have split into two payments, one for the wedding, another to the woman's father, calculated, and often paid, in silver. Wealthy women sometimes appear to have ended up with the money, at least many appear to have worn silver arm and leg rings of identical denominations. However, as time went on, this payment, called a tehartum, often began to take on the qualities of a simple purchase. It was referred to as the price of a virgin. Not a mere metaphor, since the illegal deflowering of a virgin was considered a property crime against her father. Marriage was referred to as taking possession of a woman, the same word one would use for the seizure of goods.
And that's where we're going to leave David Graeber this week due to time. I have a special request for all radio listeners, if you could email me unwelcome@unwelcomeguests.net and let me know which station you listen on and when you're listening, because I'd like to organise a global internet chat following the show, and I want to pick a time which is accessible for as many of you as possible.
This and all previous episodes on Welcome Guests are available for download as MP3s from unwelcomeguests.net/archive. There's a mailing list at altruists.org/unwelcome for any discussion relevant to the show. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening. Keep going.